This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Just a quick warning that there will be many spoilers ahead for various episodes across all the seasons of Black Mirror. You have been warned. Hello, I'm James Ide, and welcome back to the dystopia that is Black Mirror Cracked, the podcast where we discuss and analyse all things Black Mirror. We've been off air for a little while, but I've been let out of my cage to bring you another fine episode, and today we have a special one. And I mean it, this one is going to be a brain burn. So settle in, get comfy, and let's begin. Rather than listen to the uneducated ramblings of an idiot like me, you have a treat, as today my guest is Professor of Philosophy at King's College in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, Dr. David Kyle Johnson, the author of a new book, Black Mirror and Philosophy, Dark Reflections, which is out now on Amazon. Hello, Dr. David Kyle Johnson, and thank you for joining us today.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me on. You can just call me Kyle. That's great.
Thank you, Kyle. Now, you're not just a lecturer and an author. I understand you're also a massive geek. Could you tell me and the listeners some of your favorite shows and films?
So I'm sitting in my office right now, and I'm looking at a full collection of action figures from Doctor Who. And
you've made producer also, Dan, very happy.
I have every Doctor in line with the current one in the TARDIS right now. I have a full collection of Star Trek Enterprises, all the way from the NX-01 all the way up to the J.
The one-off special.
Ooh. Yes. And all but the J are in scale. The J is actually smaller because the J is like, in reality, is like 2 miles wide. I've got Star Wars all over my office. I'm a big fan of an old sci-fi show, a British sci-fi show called Blake 7.
Oh, yes, I know it well.
I have a lecture in my science fiction as philosophy course for the great courses. I've got a lecture on that compares Blake 7 to Firefly, because they're actually very similar shows, but making a similar point, but almost in opposite directions. Anyway, all versions of Star Trek, Rick and Morty, looking around my office for more Futurama. I'm into Lord of the Rings. That's not sci-fi, obviously, but I'm a big fan of Lord of the Rings. The Orville, which is a new show by Seth MacFarlane. I'm actually working on a book on that right now.
Amazing.
I
understand you own a uniform for the Orville.
I do. as you mentioned off air, I've given lectures in my captain's uniform from the Orville.
Brilliant.
I love the show, and I'm actually in the throes of working on the book. The due date for chapters was actually yesterday, essentially, for my so I'm starting to go through the chapters now, so I'm really looking forward to it. It's such a great show.
You'll definitely have to send us a picture of your office. I'll have to see all the beautiful geek paraphernalia.
I will gladly do that.
Fantastic. And we'll see if we can include it in clip notes or something. Brilliant. I think they're acceptable geek credentials. So could you also give us your name and introduce yourself and what you do? I know I've kind of covered that, but if there's anything I missed there at all?
Yeah, so technically I am a professor, not an associate professor anymore. I was recently promoted. And I've tried to get all my bios online updated, but it's impossible to keep up on it. For the book, so the project obviously I'm here to talk about is my new book, Black Mirror and Philosophy, Dark Reflections. I am the editor of the book rather than the author. It is a collection of articles by a bunch of different authors. Okay. It was my vision for the book, though, which is, this makes it unlike other books in the series. There's a whole series with Wiley Blackwell of pop culture and philosophy books that usually just use the pop culture in question as a springboard to talk about philosophical topics, which is great and wonderful. I've done the Inception book like that, and I've contributed to over 20 of them. It's awesome. But for Black Mirror, I wanted to do something different. Mm-hmm. because I think that each episode of Black Mirror, I think, has a point. That there's a point that's trying to be made, whether implicitly or explicitly. Sometimes Brooker says that he doesn't really want to preach in his and have messages, but clearly Black Mirror episodes have messages. And so I wanted the book to devote a chapter to every single episode. So there is a chapter on, you know, Hated in the Nation, and there's a chapter on, you know, Bandersnatch, and a chapter on 15 Million Merits, and all in order, right? Where you're examining that particular episode and trying to identify either the moral of the story or the questions that it raises, and then philosophically examine them. And so there are, that would be 23 chapters like that, because we have chapter all the way through. We did it all the way through season five. That wasn't easy, by the way, because the book was actually done and then season five came out. So we had to backtrack and put three more chapters in, but we did it. And then there are six chapters, seven if you count the conclusion, that are about the series as a whole at the end. They all include stuff from all five seasons. And so that's the project. I'm the co-author on a couple of chapters, but of course I was highly involved in the production of each chapter, so I know it very well. And I just got through teaching a course here at King's College where I used that book as the text. And the course was, the students go and watch the episode, they write a reflection, they come to class, and all we do is discuss the episode. They don't even read anything for that. They just watch it and then they write. And
might
then
be the only kind of course I would pass. My God, this knowledge is useful.
Well, then, and after, there is some reading involved. After we discuss the episode, they go and read the chapter on the episode, and then we come back and discuss the chapters and the philosophical themes, and, you know, I'll give bits and pieces about different philosophers that were talked about and stuff. And I just spent a whole semester doing that, just going back and forth between those. We read some of the overall chapters about the series as a whole at the end. But the students, from what I understand from my fellow professors, students all across campus are talking about it to their other professors and in their other classes. It really made an impact on them. Many students told me that it's made them think more and about more different things than any other class that they've taken. And it wasn't even that hard of a class, right? Like, but just the Black Mirror itself, and then the way that my contributors were able to delve into the episodes and bring out the philosophical content really made it work. So I'm really excited for the book to hit shelves and Amazon and that kind of stuff and be in readers' hands. But there you go.
Well, we're very excited to read it, especially me and Dan. Could you tell me which your favorite Black Mirror episode is and why? Yeah, it's a hard one. Sorry to put you on the spot.
Yeah, I think it's gonna have to be Bandersnatch.
Good choice.
Just because it deals with some of the philosophical topics that are most in my wheelhouse and that I'm most interested in. Also, just the absolute originality of it, to be able to do what they did, that they had to create software to make it work and how well the software works. But then the very kind of meta idea of, you know, you have a can we use the phrase choose your own adventure? It's that kind of episode about a person making that kind of game inspired by that kind of book, in the episode itself. And, you know, it ends with somebody making the actual thing that we're watching. Like, one of the endings at least is, you know, Pearl, Ritman at the end, making the game that we're making the Bandersnatch episode that we're watching. And then the stuff that it deals with, free will and multiverse.
And she's being controlled by the same force as Stefan.
Yes, right. And it's just brilliant in so many different ways. And I like the, you know, almost every ending. I like the way that they did the different kinds of endings where you realize that he's an actor on a set, or he goes back in time and dies with his mother. Yep. So it's got time travel in it. I like that. It's just all around just fantastic. But I will say that as endings go, Shut Up and Dance might have my favorite ending. I think that the twist is just magnificent, and the way, and I'm a big Radiohead fan, and the way they use that Radiohead song is just absolutely brilliant. So maybe, like, for endings, that may be my favorite ending of any episode. For message, it might be Smithereens. The way that it the kind of social message about digital addiction and attention seeking and the way that our attention is manipulated. It's just so good.
And I understand every episode has something, you know, that resonates.
Yeah.
Could you explain the difference between a parallel universe and a multiverse, or is it the same thing?
No. So parallel universes are part of a multiverse.
I see.
A multiverse is just a collection of universes. All right.
Yep.
And in each one of those universes, multiverse, collection of universe, and then each one of those universes is a universe parallel to the other ones, or at least as it's commonly conceived. So in relativity, for example, you've got the idea of our universe being a four-dimensional block, that essentially our universe exists as a whole, past, present, and future, all as one object. We experience it, you know, as time. We experience time passing, but Einstein suggested that was just an illusion, and that it exists all as a block. And essentially, the multiverse, at least one kind of multiverse, would be where you have multiple four-dimensional blocks like our universe stacked up in what's called the fifth dimension, or in the brain, BRANE, stacked up in a brain where they're all kind of existing parallel. They don't happen simultaneously, because simultaneity can only apply within a universe itself, but you can conceptualize them as stacked up parallel. You could have a multiverse of non-parallel universes. For example, if our universe repeats, okay, if our universe burns itself out and goes back down to a vacuum, and then you get another vacuum fluctuation, creates a big bang, another universe comes out of that. There's a great Futurama episode.
Sorry, Battlestar Galactica as well.
Yes, right? Like all this has happened before and it'll happen again, right? Like, and if that would actually be a multiverse. Each time the universe restarts, that's a separate entity, but it's not like stacked up in the brain, as it were. That's another way to conceive of a multiverse. So the way that the book treats Black Mirror is as a multiverse. All the episodes do not happen in one universe. They happen in multiple universes. But the multiverse is obviously, this is a different multiverse than what we exist in, if we exist in a multiverse or a universe. And so it's still a world that Bricker has created, but it's a world that's not a single universe. It's a multiverse. And it's a specific kind of multiverse where what happens in one universe can affect what happens, or what has happened, or can affect in some way other universes.
Yes, because they're linked, you know, obviously names so and linked, things repeat.
Right, right. They're linked, but it's not like the events of one episode happened in the same universe as the event of this other episode.
Yeah.
For example, you get like, it could be that like in Archangel, whenever she's demonstrating the Archangel's, so the nurse is demonstrating the Archangel's ability to filter out violent content, she shows the little girl a scene from Men Without Fire. And so it could be that in the Archangel universe, Men Without Fire is a television show, right?
Imagine like, that.
But then, of course, in the Archangel universe, that it's not a television show, it's real, but that's a separate universe, right? You can find some people online that try to make sense of, like, that try to put all of the Black Mirror episodes into one universe.
Yeah, it doesn't. I've seen those theories. They don't hold water for me. But
they don't work. And, like, I can actually prove this logically that they don't work. because Ashley 2, which is the last episode to air as of this recording,
yeah.
Ashley 2 has an appearance from the rapper, what's his name, Tucker, the one that was killed in,
yes,
right? But then Ashley 2 also references Black Museum. They say that there's this news story about this guy that was found burned to death in a burned out museum.
Yeah.
Right? And so Ashley 2 happens after Black Mirror, but has to happen before Hated in the Nation, because Tucker's still alive. The rapper is still alive, right?
Yep.
And yet, in Black Museum, there was one of the B drones, one of the ADIs,
yep,
right? One of the ADIs was in the Black Museum. So Black Museum in the Black Museum universe happens after Hated in the Nation, but Ashley 2 happens before it, but then Ashley 2 also happens after Black Museum. So it's a logical conundrum. There's no way to make it work. Like, if it have them all in the same universe, the only way to make it work is to have them, all the episodes exist separately in different universes where the different universes can influence one another. And by the way, this is what Brooker has said. After Black Museum, he said that it's all in one universe. I want it to be all in one. But then after, when they did Bandersnatch, he came back and said, I've changed my mind. We're just doing it's a Black Mirror multiverse. What can happen in one can affect the others, but they're not all in the same universe. And this is a brilliant move because he doesn't have
the most
to worry
freedom
about,
as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
From a narrative standpoint, it means they're not beholden to their own stories.
yeah, exactly. They don't have to worry about continuity. They don't have to worry about continuity at all. And they can just throw in references from another episode and not worry about it.
Otherwise, you have a whole Star Trek Discovery situation, and you don't want that.
No, you don't.
Sci-fi is a great lens to examine and discuss the issues of our time. And this is one of Black Mirror's greatest strengths. With this in mind, do you think the themes in Black Mirror will become dated, like, you know, the Red Menace episodes from 1950s and 60s sort of sci-fi pop culture? Or do you think these are timeless questions?
What a great question. Clearly you've been listening. All right, so... so the conclusion of the book is actually about this. It's this short piece written by Rabbi Jeff Middleton, if I'm remembering his last name correctly. Here he points out, and this actually has to do with the approach of the book, and I think a way that a lot of people misunderstand Black Mirror. Most people think that Black Mirror is about the dangers of technology. And so that, like, each episode is kind of this warning about technology and how it's taking control of us and how it's making us worse and it's making humanity worse and it's dangerous, et cetera, et cetera. You can see this demonstrated beautifully on this College Humor video where, like, if Black Mirror had been in the Middle Ages, have you guys seen this?
Yes, yeah.
Right. And, you know, the guy's like, oh, look at this new fancy invention, a plow, right? It makes planting easier. And I dug a hole to hell or whatever. And the guy in the audience is like, well, I was going to get a plow, but now I'm not going to, right? And that's how it's kind of perceived. It's just like every episode is like, ooh, the technology's dangerous. Don't do it. Don't participate. Brooker has said that's not what the series is about. And I don't think that's what the series is really about. And this is not how the book approaches the series. Brooker has said that it's not about the dangers of technology. It's not a technological problem we have. It's a human one.
Yes, and I saw this in the book. It's fantastic. This is
and what Black. Yeah, thanks. So, like, and what? Oh, go ahead. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No. Carry on, Karen, please.
So what Black Mirror does is what the moral of most episodes is about. It's about a human foible. It's about a human flaw. It's something that we do wrong. It's something that's wrong about us. And the advanced technology, or sometimes not even advanced technology, like in episodes like Smithereen, right? The very first episode, National Anthem.
Oh, sorry,
I screw those up too. I cross all the time. But like those don't involve advanced technology. But what they're doing, the technology that exists in the episode amplifies the human foible and makes it more obvious and makes it more pronounced so that we can see it and examine it and realize it and then hopefully maybe even change something about ourselves, right? And so with certain exceptions, like Smithereens might be a warning about Facebook and Twitter. Like it might be a warning about the technology. Maybe Metalhead is a warning about artificial intelligence. But the best example of this, and I think most other episodes are like this, is Archangel. Archangel is not about the dangers of the Archangel technology.
Yeah.
The Archangel technology in Archangel amplifies Marie, right? That's the mother's name.
Yes.
Right? Marie's her propensity to overparent, to be a helicopter parent, to be a bulldozer parent, to watch everything and filter everything that she does, it amplifies her overparenting, enables her to overparent way more than she would be able to otherwise, right?
The technology isn't inherently bad, and you know, there's even a point where she knows that if she leaves it, if she doesn't look, you know, nothing bad will come from it.
Right,
but
right.
Of course she can't help but look.
Yes, and if you limited it to just like whenever she's younger, if you just limit it to like location services, right, and like tracking her vitals, that would be fine, right? But when she turns the filter on, that's too much. But we already do, like, we already filter what our kids see, right? Parents already do this. The Archangel device just allows them to do it more, but there's not just as much danger, but there's an equally – the same type of danger is there for us without the Archangel device in Overparenting itself. And a lot of the episodes are like this. They're not about the technology. They're about the human foible that
how
the
we
technology
would abuse them.
Magnifies, like how we would abuse them because we are because we are flawed. Right. And so, like, I just wrote a blog article for Psychology Today on the Waldo moment. And it was kind of inspired by the course that I taught this semester, because even though the Waldo moment was the episode that my students kind of panned as being the worst episode of all of them, I think it's the most important, because maybe this contradicts what I said a while ago about smithereens being the most important. But like, I think it's the most important because the message is not about Waldo. It's not about the dangers of the kind of animated technology and that could, like, that a politician could use in the way that they describe in the episode. And it's not even about all politicians being fake like Waldo. The message, the danger is the human foible that's amplified is the human tendency for their political involvement to only be as deep as I don't like the establishment. I don't like the way things are. And that's as deep as it goes. There's no extra. And so what we should be doing is such and such and such. Things should change in these kinds of ways. It's just because that's all Waldo is. And this is stated explicitly in the episode. All Waldo is anti-establishment.
Yeah, he has no real policies or anything. Yeah. He just he's anti-establishment and he's a character.
Right. And the secret agent from America that comes over says, this, anyone can use this. You can tie any political idea to Waldo because he doesn't stand for anything except for being anti-establishment. And everybody's anti-establishment. Everybody doesn't like the way things are, right? But that means that fascists could come in and start using Waldo as a logo. And then they could rise to power, right? They just say, hey, we're against the establishment. Aren't you too? Yes. And since you don't bother to ask what they're going to do after they take control, they can do whatever the hell they want, right? Mm-hmm. Notice that, to talk American politics, right? Notice that, make America great again, right? America first, that kind of, like, these are all slogans that are just like against the establishment as it currently stands with no specifics about what's going to happen afterwards.
Yes. It appeals to that emotional side rather than any kind of actual.
Yes. Right. And so what Waldo's about is this human foible of our political disengagement. It is a warning about either political disengagement or your engagement only going as deep as fuck the establishment. That's dangerous. So anyway, if you're more interested in that, I got a whole 4-series blog post up on Psychology Today about that. Check it out. But anyway, go ahead.
You refer to Black Mirror as a science fiction, but just barely. So what do you think sets Black Mirror apart from high sci-fi like Star Trek or Westworld or Altered Carbon?
Yeah, so it's one of the reasons is because it's not mired in complete overarching. So like Star Trek is set way, way in the future, right? Battlestar Galactica is in the past, but it's the technology is like way, way advanced. You got starships and all that kind of stuff, right? Same thing with Star Wars, although some people call Star Wars fantasy, right? But you got spaceships and laser guns and all blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
Like with Black Mirror, it's the technology is just advanced kind of barely beyond what we have in most cases, right? Like it's technology that you could kind of see coming and is sort of plausible. And in some cases was actually ahead of its time and it's already come to pass. Like Nosedive is a great example where there's already social ranking systems in China, like the ones that were described in Nosedive. Right. And then I say barely because like I mentioned before, episodes like The National Anthem and like Smithereen, and I'm trying to come up with another example. I feel like there's one more. Don't involve any advanced technology, right? They're just set in modern day, right? I guess I should say Bandersnatch is another one that doesn't involve any advanced technology because it's set in the past. If taken by itself, The National Anthem is not sci-fi, right, at all.
Yeah.
Because it's got a moral message and all that kind of stuff that sci-fi does, but there's no advanced technology isolated by itself. That's not a science fiction episode. Same thing with Smithereens. It's not because Smithereens is just Facebook. It's really Twitter, and I think Persona, the thing called Persona in that episode is Facebook, and Smithereens is Twitter, right? But like it's just existing technology with a name that we have. Maybe potentially the phone technology in Smithereens is a little advanced. I'm not sure, but other than that, right? Like,
but utterly believable. That's the thing. Like you
totally
accept it pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So, and that's what I mean by it's barely science fiction, is that it's just kind of barely advanced, and it's not, the technology is, in a lot of ways, it's the focus, not the focus as in the dangers of or whatever, but like, in Star Trek, technology is just treated differently. It's just taken for the technology is not the focus in a certain kind of way. It's a method for telling the story. Whereas in Black Mirror, the technology is kind of the focus, not entirely. Like I said, it's more about human foibles, but it's focused in a different kind of way. But anyway,
it also feels like typical sci-fi shows like Star Trek have a kind of blanket high technology, whereas yeah. Black Mirror is often one aspect of that technology taken to an extreme point. The rest of society is usually very similar to or the same as what we currently have. It's just this yes. one aspect of technology that's advanced and everything else is kind of at the same level.
Yeah, like that's a really good, for Star Trek, that's really easy to see, right? Like in Star Trek, they live in a completely different world than we do, right? A unified Earth and a federation of planets and starships and da-da-da-da-da, right? Black Mirror, they're almost in our world. There's like one thing that's different.
You could even transplant some Star Trek things into Black Mirror as long as they only took that one technology and talked about right. what that means. They could take replicators and go, well, economies have now collapsed because, you know, right. replicators have rendered economy obsolete, or transporters, you know, the dangers right. of that. You know, they could just focus on the one thing and how we would, well, as we said, abuse that, or how human beings would take that.
Yeah, the only thing that would make those differences, I think those particular two technologies that you mentioned are a little bit too advanced for Black Mirror.
Yes, true.
Right? Like you wouldn't look at that and go, oh, that could happen tomorrow. Like most Black Mirror episodes, you look at it and say, oh, that maybe could happen tomorrow. Maybe the exception to that is the cookie tech. The cookie tech is probably a little bit more advanced than we give it credit for. Like, I mean, Ray Kurzweil would say that it's you know, it's going to happen by 2050 or whatever, but I think that's an overestimate.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Go ahead.
So the idea that we, in fact, have no free will and we may not be responsible for our decisions could have terrifying implications. Could this also be liberating if, like Stefan, we just, well, in one of his endings, he just accepts it?
Yeah, I don't think so. So there's a section of this on the in the Bandersnatch chapter. And so I should mention that the chapter that we wrote for Bandersnatch, and this actually happened in the middle of editing the book. We had 19 chapters written for the existing episodes, and then Bandersnatch came out. And we're like, okay, so what are we going to do? How do we want to approach this? I had a couple of ideas. And then one of the co-authors, one of the contributors for one of the other chapters, Chris Lay, came to me and said, I've got a great idea. Let's do a choose your own philosophical adventure chapter for Bandersnatch, where you have a section and then you have different questions and the reader gets to decide which question they want to explore more. And I was like, that's a great idea. This is the best thing ever. I love this plan. I'm excited to be a part of it. Let's do it. So I mapped it all out, where we would talk about and da-da-da-da and how it would go and the different ways, the selections, it would circle back on itself. And there's five different endings and yada, yada, yada. But we have this beautiful, I'm very proud of, choose your own philosophical adventure chapter in the Black Mirror book for Bandersnatch. And one of the sections, like one of the main themes that goes through it, or at least one of the paths that goes through this chapter, is this idea of free will and are we really free? And ultimately, if we're not free, does that liberate us? Does that mean that we're not responsible for our actions anymore and we can do whatever the hell we want? There are multiple reasons for thinking that we're not free. Everything from, if we really do live in a four-dimensional universe where the future is already exists, well, then the future already exists. There's nothing you can do but what you will do, right? Like there's no alternate possibilities. The fact that it looks like the way that you behave is dictated by your neural structure, and your neural structure is outside of your control. It's dictated by your, you know, your genetics and environment. And so you really can't do otherwise than what you do. And so there's multiple reasons for thinking that you have free will. Is this liberating though? I don't think so. It's certainly not in the way that Stefan seems to think that it is liberating. it means that you're just absolved of all responsibility for what you're going to do, and that you can just kind of do whatever you want because maybe fate wants you to murder someone, so just go ahead and murder. There's a couple of different ways, a couple of different reasons for that. One is that some philosophers don't think that free will requires alternate possibilities, and certainly they don't think that moral responsibility requires alternate possibilities. So even if you're not able to do otherwise, you can still be morally responsible for what you did because you're the one that did it. Guy named Markosian has a really good theory of free will called agent. It's a compatibilist theory of agent causation. But essentially, the idea, as long as you, the agent, are the one who did the action, then you freely did it and you're morally responsible for it, regardless of whether you couldn't have done otherwise. So you're still morally responsible even if you couldn't have done otherwise. Others like Frankfurt would say, as long as you're acting in accordance with your second order wants and desires, you're free and morally responsible. Fisher would say, as long as you did what you did as a result of a rational deliberation, then you did so freely and are morally responsible. So even if we're not free in the traditional libertarian alternate possibility ways that we usually think of when we think of free will, it's still entirely possible that we're morally responsible for what we do. But secondly, this is one of the pieces of Bandersnatch that disturbed me. The lady that's doing the documentary about Davies, the guy who wrote the original, right? She's like, so he came to believe he didn't have free will. If you don't have free will, you just do whatever you want. Maybe fate wants you to be a murderer. So why not murder? And the answer to that question is because maybe fate doesn't want you to murder, right? Like,
it's not the only viable option.
Yes, right. Like, if we are fated in that way, then we can't not do whatever we're fated to do. But since we don't know what we're fated to do, we can't ever say, so I might as well just do such and such. Yeah, exactly. Like, you might as well just do such and such because maybe that's what I'm fated to do. Well, no, that's the, you may be fated to do something else. You still notice that regardless of whether you have free will, you'll still be held responsible for what you do, right? So even if you believe that you don't have free will, or, you know, can't shake that philosophical intuition or can't shake that philosophical conclusion that we don't have free will, you still should be trying to reason out what the best thing to do is and then do it. Like, it's not an excuse to just go murder people or whatever, right? Like, now Stefan obviously doesn't understand that, and so he goes and murders a dad, at least in one of the endings.
Yeah.
Or a couple of the endings, I guess. But I don't think it's liberating in that way.
That leads on quite well to the next question, which is, the white bear symbol pertaining to binary choice ignores one option, which you mention in the book, and it's often given to us in computer games, but we didn't have it in Bandersnatch, and that is inaction. Is inaction an important option, and what is lost by its removal? I mean, do we just move like a car without brakes until eventually we crash?
Right. Yeah. So, like, I mean, there sort of is inaction because if you do, you can do nothing whenever the choices pop up. But then the computer, like, the system just chooses for you.
Yeah. Right. But in a game, sometimes the state will, nothing will be forced. So while you may not progress, you won't necessarily do, I don't know, let's say it's a game that has something horrible happen next. That person may never die if you never progress. Therefore, your inaction is a choice. And in life, you know, given a choice, you can choose to not act, which a lot of people do for certain things.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure what else to say about it other than it's like it can force you to, like, there's an interesting question about whether or not choices that you make in Bandersnatch are immoral or not. Like, literally, you're doing something immoral by choosing chop up dad rather than bury dad, right? Like, in the same way that you worry that we talk about this in my class, in the same way that you worry about somebody, if somebody's playing Grand Theft Auto and they decide to have sex with and then murder a hooker in the game, right? Like, you might wonder, like, oh yeah, it's just a game, but haven't you kind of done something wrong by doing this in the game, right? Or more appropriately, maybe more accurately, maybe you haven't done something wrong, but maybe you revealed something about your character that's a little disturbing, right? By choosing to do this in the game. And so you might worry about the same thing with Bandersnatch, right? That maybe by not giving us choices, it's forcing us to do something disturbing, maybe forcing us to do something immoral, or at least revealing something about ourselves. I'm sure if I'm answering your question quite right. there is the choice of inaction though, because you can just shut it off.
Yeah, that's right? A good point.
If when it comes to bury dad or chop up dad, you can just go, neither, thank you, and just
I'm out,
and just,
done.
And just turn it off, right?
Yeah.
There is a kind of moral quandary by forcing, if you're going to play the game, it forces these kind of decisions on you. And that may be worrying, but I'm not sure I answered your question or not, James.
Does this change if you are viewing or playing with other people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to, right? That because you're part of a group at that point, and then the group can be responsible for
you chose the to choices. Chop him up, you monster. Why would you do that? Why do we want to watch that?
I mean, I guess if you're a dissenter of the group, maybe you're not as responsible as the group if the group overrules you.
What's Dan told you about me? How did you know?
but that's another interesting question in and of itself. Can groups be held morally responsible for their actions? And then you can also flip this to what degree are persons responsible for belonging to groups? And if the group does something bad, then are you partly responsible for what the group did, even though you didn't do it directly?
Yeah.
I've got a paper on this that relates directly to religion and moral culpability when it comes to choosing to be religious or choosing to be a part of a religious group, right? If you belong to a particular religious group, and then the group or even just someone in that group does something immoral in the name of a belief that that group finds to be identifying, right? Like everyone in that group belongs to that group because they believe X, and then someone in that group, because they believe X, goes off and murders someone. Are you partly responsible for that behavior? Not as much responsible as they are, but are you at least partly morally culpable for that? Because
like the Manson family or...
Yeah, right? Like the Manson family, or I'm thinking a really easy example would be someone who belongs to, easy example, Westboro Baptist Church.
Yep.
Right. Like, and somebody belongs to that church, but they don't go to the protests. Right. And they don't hold up the signs, the placards at the funerals and that on that kind of stuff. Right. But they still belong.
And they still hold those values.
And they still hold those values. Right. And that they like maybe they tithe or whatever, they give money to the group. But even if they don't, like if they just go to church there on Sundays, right, the group wouldn't exist without members. And so by being a member, you're contributing to the existence of the group. And so, and the group does bad thing, and so you're partly culpable for that, right? And it's an interesting question about how far this goes, right? Like, if people do bad things in the name of believing in God, and you believe in God, are you partly morally responsible for that? And so there's this kind of reverse question too. And so if you're participating in Bandersnatch in a group, all those questions come back up. Now it's not as serious as actually murdering someone because it is just a television show. Dad's not really being chopped up, but one of the sections in the Bandersnatch.
No, luckily Craig Parkinson is alive and well. We met him on a previous podcast. He's a lovely man.
I remember listening to that podcast. To the degree that maybe we can make immoral choices in games, and again, there's a section in Bandersnatch on this. There would be some moral culpability there. Hopefully, that answered your question.
No, it does. It's fantastic. Thank you. Okay, could you explain to our listeners, especially those who aren't as well versed in philosophy like myself, the links between Black Mirror specifically and philosophy?
Yeah, so I think that, as I kind of mentioned before, I think that the individual episodes are either making some kind of philosophical point or raising a philosophical question. And that's where the link can happen. And what we try to do in the book is link those things up. We try to identify what the, you know, the philosophical point or question of each episode is. And by doing that, you can actually explore and educate yourself about different philosophical theories or positions or even philosophers. So easy example, White Bear. Mm-hmm. White Bear raises specific questions about criminal punishment and what the purpose of criminal punishment should be. So in debates on this, there are essentially two views on the subject, that criminal punishment should be retributive or it should be rehabilitative. The
you
retributive-
can't be rehabilitated if your memory is wiped, et cetera.
Well, yeah, exactly, right? So what's going on in White Bear is completely retributive. It is all about vengeance.
Yeah.
It is the idea that Victoria Scalane has done something morally wrong and she deserves to be punished for it. And so we're going to give her what she deserves. And since they're wiping her memory every time, as you pointed out, it is very clear that there is no rehabilitation that's going on. She's not going to learn her lesson and be a different person and be a better person. Right. She can't because she forgets whatever lessons she learns every time. Right. And so that chapter like brings that out and talks about these two theories of punishment and which one you should prefer and which one would be better. Not to mention the fact that this one also raises the question of whether they're actually punishing the person who did the crime, because since her memory of the crime has been erased, there is a question about whether or not she actually is the same person. And I don't mean the same kind of person, whether she is numerically the same object.
That's brilliant. I was literally about to say that. I was like, is she even the same person if she hasn't got the memories of said event? Is she even culpable to it?
Right. So it might not even be retributive, because they're not even punishing the person who did the crime.
By this point, it's punishment for punishment's sake, surely.
Yes, right? Like, it's just punishing someone because the public needs someone to be punished for the crime, right? And that's all it is. And so they're just punishing someone who actually is innocent because they're a different person.
Yeah.
Right? Or another episode that I think does this particularly well, the chapter on Hated in the Nation. Elaine Maya wrote this chapter, and kind of at my behest, because this is what I noticed. The death to hashtag in Hated in the Nation is something that, of course, it happens on Twitter, and it's something that can end people's lives. When people become hated in the nation, right? When they become hated, everyone puts a death to hashtag, and they end up getting killed by the ADIs, right? Okay. So the episode seems to be like the reason that the antagonist in that episode did what he did was because this girl that he worked with almost committed suicide because she was publicly shamed for something that she did on Twitter, right? And he puts this manifesto out that says essentially, like, we need to help hold people responsible for their online behavior because they don't understand that it has real world consequences, right? Yeah. And so the moral of the episode seems to kind of be that online shaming is always bad. Right. Never participate in it. You shouldn't participate in it. It's got legitimate power. Don't online shame people. It's always wrong. Right. And the example, of course, the episode gives is hashtag death to.
Yeah.
The episode airs almost exactly a year before Alyssa Milano popularizes hashtag Me Too. Not death to, but Me Too. And Me Too has kind of the same power that the Death to hashtag does. It can't kill people, but it can end careers. It can completely change lives, right? It can take people out. But here's the difference, though, right? Is that the Me Too hashtag seems to be doing something good. It's holding people accountable for behavior that they would get away with if it were not for the Me Too hashtag, right? It brings Harvey Weinstein to justice. It exposes Bill Cosby, right? Like, so it's doing some good. And so this really—
and without killing these people, it just, you know, obviously it just highlights the awful things they have done.
Right, right. But it is trial by Twitter.
Yeah.
Right? But it is getting some just results in certain cases, right? And so this really complicates the moral of the episode, which is never participate in online shaming. It's always bad. Because sometimes it can be good. But in the same breath, right, you can't forget that even with Me Too, as noble as the aspirations and the goals are, it could still potentially be abused. And so you have to guard against, right, like the different ways that it could be abused and be aware of the way they could be abused as you're using it, et cetera. And so what Aline has done in this chapter is very risky. Right. It's because she's like she's on the edge of a knife here, going like, we have to be honest about the dangers of online shaming, but we also have to be honest about the potential benefits that it has. And as people who are like in the real world who are trying to figure out when you should participate and when you shouldn't, you need to be looking at both sides of the coin to figure out where that you draw that line and when you should participate and when you shouldn't, right? And ultimately, it's not even that controversially of a conclusion, because the conclusion is we need to be careful.
Right?
but this is an extremely philosophical issue, right? That you need philosophy to pull out and to recognize and to look at the different aspects of and the arguments on both sides. And I think Elaine's done a really good job on that. And another really good episode of where you have philosophy and the bridge between philosophy and Black Mirror is Nosedive. So Jean-Paul Sartre has this idea of the look. And I'm not an existentialist, and I don't study Sartre, so I'm not an expert on this. But generally, the look, Sartre argued famously, or he did so in a play called No Exit, where there's a line in it that says, "Hell is other people." and in No Exit, what happens is three people are in a waiting room in hell. They've died and they've gone to hell, but they're in a waiting room awaiting their torturer to show up. And the play explicates their conversation that they have while they're sitting there waiting for their torturer. And they tell each other their stories, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what they eventually realize, and so like one of the things that happens is the guy in the story reveals that he didn't fight in such and such a war because he was a principled, pacifist. And one of the ladies in the, one of the other ladies in the room says, that's BS. You weren't a pacifist. You were just a coward. No, I was a pacifist. No, you were a coward. And he essentially devotes all of eternity to trying to convince her otherwise, to convince her that he was a principled pacifist rather than a coward. And what they eventually realize is that there is no torturer. There is no torturer coming. This is their hell, to be locked in a room with each other, all of them looking at each other, judging each other, right? Drawing conclusions about the kind of person that they are and what they're doing, and the hell that is you trying to control how other people see you and being looked at by other people and them judging you and them looking at you and making conclusions about who you are, and you trying to rectify that and you trying to project yourself in a certain kind of way so you're perceived in the way that you kind of want to. And this is their hell. This is what it means for hell to be other people, right?
Yeah.
And of course, the moral of the story is that, guess what? This is the world we live in, right? Like, we live in a hell because we are constantly looking at each other in the way that Sartre described, and we're constantly preoccupied by how people judge us and how people view us, and we're trying to control how they view us or see us or conceive of us, and that's the hell that we're in. And what social media does is amplify that. Like, social media exists almost exclusively, except for like politics, it exists to do two things: political misinformation, and then to facilitate our looking at each other and the way that we want to be looked at, right? And so you have this pressure to put yourself forth on social media in a way that you want to be perceived. And then, of course, you are perceiving other people. And so you're constantly worried about other people, the way other people perceive you, and you're constantly worried about how you perceive them, and they're worried about you. And it's like the social media magnifies Sartre's concerns about the look.
If only Sartre knew.
Right. He would be horrified, right? and what Nosedive does is illustrate Sartre's look beautifully, that and this idea of the look being of hell being other people, and the look being oppressive, it illustrates this beautifully. And that's why, interestingly, like, Nosedive has got one of the only happy endings, is because Lacey and the guy across from her in the other cell have both been liberated from the rating technology. And so they're no longer looking at each other or being looked at, right? They no longer care what anyone else thinks. And so this is why they are truly happy at the end, swearing at each other and throwing insults back and forth or whatever, because they don't have to worry about it. They have been liberated from the look, right? And this is, even though they're in jail, this is why it's the happy ending. Anyway.
True, contradictory, kind of crazy ending that Black Mirror likes to chuck in there, yes, occasionally. Brilliant, thank you. Why do you think the Black Mirror has resonated so well with a global audience? What is it about these dark reflections of our society that are so appealing to us?
That's a really good question. I think the answer is simple. Because it's true. And obviously it's fiction, right? And so, like, I actually start the introduction of the book with a quote from Fee, from The Entire History of You, where she says, I'm going off memory here, but like, not everything that isn't true is a lie.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Right? And she's referring to her stories about, like, you know, what she said about her relationship. But in Black Mirror fashion, I open the book with that quote because I'm reinterpreting it in the same way that Black Mirror reinterprets songs for their endings. This is another very common Black Mirror trope, where you get a song that means something completely different than it originally meant, like in Smithereens, I Can't Take My Eyes Off of You. Mm-hmm. Obviously it wasn't about Twitter, but anyway. And so I am reinterpreting that line to suggest that what's going on with Black Mirror is that, I think the reason it resonates with people is that it's true. Again, it's fiction, so it's not literally true, but the messages that it gets across, the things that it, the philosophical questions it raises and the answers it proposes, the points that it makes, the social commentary that it makes are spot on. And it can do that in a way, I think, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to edit this book so bad, is because from the first time I saw a Black Mirror episode, I was like, oh, there's definitely a point there, but I'm not exactly sure what it is. But whatever it is, it's right. Like, before figuring out what the message of the show was, I could still say, but whatever it is, it's right. Like, this episode is onto something. It is dead right. It is accurately describing, it's adequately criticizing something, but I'm not even sure what it is, but it's definitely right. Right. And then I wanted to get in and dig and figure out what that was. And that's kind of what the book does, is it goes through each episode and tries to figure out what that is. Right. But I think that mystery of knowing not exactly what its point is, but it's onto something, is intriguing. And so that's why it resonates with people. But then especially when people figure out what it's doing and the point it's making, people go, yeah, that is just, it's dead on. It resonates. It's true. And I think it may not change the entire human race, but I think it can change people, right? Like, I know that when people watch some people watching Nosedive, it caused them to get off social media. Wow. They stopped with Snap. Now, this was in the Inside Black Mirror book, but you had quotes from people saying that, like, I stopped doing Snapchat after that, because I realized I'd become obsessed with it, and I was obsessed with how people were ranking me and looking at me, et cetera, et cetera. People have realized that, some people are inspired to create the memory technology in the entire history of you, and other people are realizing that would not be a good thing to do. And that to the extent that Facebook allows us to do that kind of things, people don't do it anymore. I think people definitely are more cognizant. I know I am, as a result of watching Smithereen, that I'm more cognizant of the way that Facebook, for example, tries to draw my attention, tries to keep my attention, profits off my attention, essentially makes, this is one of the points the chapter makes on Smithereens, is that Facebook has turned me into a unpaid employee. Because every time I'm on Facebook generating information about my wants and preferences and needs and desires and interests, et cetera, I am creating a target for them to sell advertising to. Mm-hmm. And so the book essentially argues that we are all unpaid employees of Facebook. Every time we get on, we're producing monetary value for them. Right. And I am much more cognizant of that after watching Smithereen and reading the chapter. And so I think that it can change people's lives. It won't change the whole human race, but it can make individual differences. And I think people resonate with that as well.
Brilliant. Do you think Charlie Brooker is doing this on purpose? Do you think it's all written this way, so cleverly layered? Or do you think it's just how we read into it? Do you think it's the human condition?
Yeah, so there's a quote from Brooker, and I can't remember where it appears in the book, but maybe it's in the introduction. He essentially says, like, I don't want to be preachy. I'm not trying to preach my moral truth to anybody or whatever. And so he would deny that he has a moral message for the episodes. And maybe consciously he doesn't. But I think that at least unconsciously, if not somewhere deep down, that
some of his moral values are bleeding into.
Or conclusions that he's drawn, or observations that he's made, and conclusions that he puts those in the episode. I mean, you can't watch Smithereen and not think that he's got some kind of concerns about the way that Facebook and Twitter draw our attention. And even if it's just as simple as, it can cause accidents because people are distracted by, distracted by alerts and that kind of stuff. He's got to have something with Ashley too. He's got to have some kind of, idea about authenticity and artistic expression and that kind of stuff. Right. Nosedive. He's concerned about the effect of social media and the look and that kind of stuff. For National Anthem, he has to be concerned about our preoccupation with spectacle. I mentioned this in the this is mentioned in the book that you know when they did the press junket and showed this to the London press corps or whatever for the press corps is not the right word but the, like the media the press screening right for the first time and you know Brooker's known for some comedy and that kind of stuff right when the episode starts. And, you know, the premise of the prime minister is going to have to screw a pig on national television is revealed, right? People laugh, right? They thought it was funny. It's like, oh, here Brooker goes again with these silly, you know, these silly comedic antics or whatever. And that when that moment comes in the episode.
It's not funny. It's not played for laughs.
Well, here's what happened in the screening is that before, like right before it happens, the people, the press watching it were reacting like the people in the bar. They were jovial. They were joking. They had smiles on their faces. They're like, oh my God, I can't believe what we're about to watch. This is crazy. And then as it happens on the episode and you see what happens, they did exactly what the people in the bar did. They all pulled themselves back. They started to look away. They started to like, basically like, oh my God, what are we watching? And why are we watching this? Right? Like they reacted in the same kind of way. And there's this sense of shame where you really are part of the audience in the episode in this, right? Like you're
complicit in the crime.
And you're complicit in the crime, right? Like it is in real time, it is criticizing the kind of reaction that you are giving to the episode. Right, you were reveling in the spectacle. You were looking forward to watching it. You would be one of the people in the bar saying, you know, don't turn it off, right? And it's criticizing that in the moment that you're doing it, and it's just, and it's brilliant. And you can't, I can't imagine that Brooker does not have this in mind when he writes the episode, that he has that criticism of spectacle in his head as he's writing it. Has to be. So he would say no. But I think that there's something going on.
There definitely is, yeah.
And you could also just divorce it. Like, maybe it doesn't matter whether Brooker is or not. And that's kind of how I usually treat science fiction. There's certainly in my great courses course, sci-fi, science fiction as philosophy. I treat it that way. I'm not concerned about authorial intent. I am concerned about what the media as it stands says and argues and is trying to get across, right? And kind of regardless of what the intentions of the author is, I look at it that way. And so maybe the answer to your question is I don't necessarily care. Like I sort of do, but like ultimately philosophically, I don't care whether Brooker's trying to get something across or not. His episodes definitely get something across and I want to identify and examine what that is. And that's what the book does.
Brilliant. What technology from Black Mirror unnerves you the most and which one would you want in your life?
Okay, the one I want in my life is easy, the pizza delivery system from Crocodile.
What a good choice. I mean, I've always wanted the grain from Entire History of You, but my God, that is such a better choice.
I mean, it doesn't seem to be too dangerous. It only runs over people occasionally.
Well,
right?
Yeah.
Right? Like it's you know, it's just a pizza shop on wheels that just delivers hot pizza right to your door. I mean, what could be better?
I could use that right now. That'd be fantastic.
I would argue against your grain. I think the grain is actually one of the more dangerous ones.
Oh, definitely. 100%. And I've admitted on previous podcasts that I would absolutely use it like Liam does. I would totally scrutinize everything I do. I'd probably be more critical of myself than others, especially because of the nature of what we're doing, it being a podcast and from some of the other things we do here. You know, being able to see myself or my writing or hear my voice can be very critical. I'm sure everyone is when you hear your own voice or when you see your face on a video or on a picture, you're like, oh, I don't like that.
Yes. And notice how this illustrates beautifully the idea that like Entire History of You, it's not about the grain.
No,
It's about that human foible. It's about that propensity to overanalyze, to be overcritical, to nitpick, to get into other people's business, to try to find out everything, like especially with Liam, right? To try to find everything out about Fee and dig up her past and figure out figure out everything about her or whatever. And that the grain amplifies our ability to do that, and it destroys his world.
Wouldn't it be amazing though to have that uncolored view of an event that's happened, because obviously our memory is very subjective, but also so is your perspective. So to just have a clean look at something happened.
Yeah. I mean, it would, like, and it would, like, this is, so this is what the chapter in the, in the chapter in the book on this episode is about. This, I think the subtitle is literally like, should we want the grain? And one of the points it does make is that it would come with huge benefits, right? Because you're right, human memory is very, very fallible. That's mentioned in the episode, right? And so grain technology would rectify that, right? It would alleviate that worry about the fallibility of memory. But it may not be worth the price. So here's something that the chapter does point out quite brilliantly. Notice what the grain technology would do to trust and the ability of a couple to be in a trusting relationship. You would never be able to trust anyone to have ever done what they said or not done what they said or whatever, to be faithful or whatever it is, because you could always just say, oh yeah, we'll just prove it then, right? And everything would just be like, you would almost eliminate conversation, right? Like, you would just replay what happened instead of telling people about it, right? You would lose control over the narrative of your story.
Yeah.
But it would also, it would be impossible to just implicitly trust, would be unnecessary at that point, because you could always just examine the grain footage, right?
Oh yeah, you'd always have the absolute of a situation.
But on the flip side, it seems that human relationships are only possible if trust is required. That part of being in a relationship with someone is trusting them, and that the best relationships are ones where trust flows both ways. And trust couldn't flow anyway in a world where everyone had a grain.
I mean, another one that I find particularly terrifying is the mass system. I think human beings already have the ability to dehumanize each other pretty well without any kind of computer aid.
Yeah, I was looking at the TOC for the book, and I was kind of trying to figure out which one, and that's actually the one I was about to hone in on. So I think that if it's not the grain, then it's the mass system from Men Without Fire. Because, and this is what this chapter is about, because it, again, amplifies a human foible, and that is our propensity to dehumanize other people, and to dehumanize minorities, and to make excuses for it, and to even exterminate them, right? And the mass device just enables us to kind of do that on steroids, essentially, right? But we already do that to a large degree. The episode calling them roaches was inspired by a British politician, I forget which one, calling immigrants cockroaches. Like, that's why Brooker chose that particular word. And that's happened before, right? Like, in American politics, you've got Trump calling people those kinds of names, roaches and insects, or vermin, calling immigration.
And famously, the Nazis used those kind of terminology to refer to the Jews and anyone they deemed undesirable.
Right. And in World War, the Nazis did that in World War II to the Jews, right? Yeah. But then Americans also did it to the Japanese.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And the Japanese did it to us, right? And that dehumanizing propaganda exists in war, but it also exists outside of war, right? Like when Trump calls immigration an infestation and that kind of stuff, clearly the infestation implies insects, right? Like roaches. And so it's dangerous. That's one of the most dangerous things that already exists. So maybe the point to be put, that's one of our most dangerous human foibles. And so if the mass device were actually real, it could amplify that foible tenfold. And that could be the most disturbing piece of technology in Black Mirror, because of the way that it would amplify that human foible.
Definitely. Oof, terrifying. Right? Another interesting question for you. Is Colin Rittman a god, an enlightened prophet, or a whacked out space cadet? Is there any lessons we can learn from our Lord and Savior, Colin Rittman?
So Colin Rittman, is he a god? If he's a god, he's like a Gandalf character. And Gandalf is kind of on the pantheon. He's like a servant to one of the gods in Lord of the Rings. There's Elvatar, and there's the kind of sub-gods, and they all have servants, and like Melkor, Morgoth is one of those servants, and then below him is Sauron, right? And then you've got, I forget which god that Gandalf's a prophet of or whatever, but like an angel of. But and that's what Colin would be. He'd be like this, not a god in the sense of he rules over the universe and controls it, but he's like inside the universe and he understands it, and he can manipulate it in a certain
some sort
kind
of multiverse guide.
Yes, right. Like, he's, yeah, a multiverse guide, right? That's a really good term. And so he's kind of like an angel, or getting it. Maybe a prophet's the right kind of word, because he understands it and understands how it works, right? He understands his nature as a digital being and what it means and implies. Now what can we learn from him? I assume you're referring to the little bit in one of my emails where I suggested that I just recently read some papers which suggest that maybe we live in a world kind of like Bandersnatch.
Yeah.
So let me what I'm going off of here is a series of papers by a guy named Marcus Arvan. And he argues that so let me back up a smidge. God, this is gonna take too long. I'm gonna make this really, really quick.
Sure.
All right. So Nick Bostrom, an Oxford philosopher, has persuasively argued that the probability that we actually live in a computer simulation is about 20%. And I've published on this. You can look at my work on academia.edu. Just Google academia.edu, David Kell Johnson. You can look up my academic work, and you can find my stuff on the simulation hypothesis. I've done a couple of articles on this, even specifically arguing for why it's about 20%. It's a subjective probability, but a subjective probability about 20% that we live in a computer simulation.
Wow.
All right. So Arvan is not arguing for that specific number, 20%. But what he's arguing is that the idea, the hypothesis that we live in a particular kind of simulation might be the best explanation for our existence, in that it solves, where nothing else can solve, a number of problems that we have not solved yet. And these are highly technical problems, but there are problems that exist in quantum mechanics, like how particles can have multiple contradictory properties at once, which quantum mechanics entails, that things are in a superposition and a particle can be literally in two places at once or have two velocities at once. How our measurement of quantum systems of these superpositions can make them collapse down into having one particular location or velocity and none others at that point. And then when you stop observing it, it goes back to being in superposition. Wave-particle duality, the non-locality of quantum phenomena that you've got when things are quantum entangled, you've got spooky action at a distance, where when one particle takes on a property, its paired particle will take on the opposite property, and it will always do so even if they're light years apart. The fact that, and you can even go to relativity, you've got relative, in relativity, certain things like simultaneity are relative to reference frame and your observer and the observer. And even like problems, like he says that like all the evidence seems to suggest, like if you look at the philosophical and physical evidence, it all seems to suggest that we are not free, and yet we can't shake the feeling that we are free. Attempts to make sense of personal identity, of what it means to be the same person over time, all break down, and yet we still can't shake the intuition that we are the same person over time. So what Arvan argues is that the hypothesis that we are in what's called a peer-to-peer computer simulation answers all of these questions. A peer-to-peer computer simulation is one like Halo, where everybody has a disk, and then their computer reads that disk, but the world that you're playing in is created by each individual computer reading that disk and creating a visual point of view for the person. And then the world is created when those different computers communicate with each other and tell each other like what they're reading and what information that they're processing and where they think things are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And that's the world that's created, okay? And the idea here would be that the universe, as it were, is just digital information. It's two-dimensional digital information that's being processed, interpreted by different processors, and that's us, right? And that the world that we live in is created as we process that information. And so, you know, like Colin says, that our choices are dictated by the spirit outside this world.
Yeah.
Right? Someone else is controlling us. If this is right, if the P2P simulation hypothesis is right, and I should be clear, I am not doing it justice. You just need to go read his papers. It's Marcus Arvan, A-R-V-A-N. He's got three that are really good. That if this is right, then your choices, what your body does in this world, is dictated by something that exists outside of it, which would be the processor, that's processing the information and making the choices for what we do. And then obviously it's what experiences the world, et cetera, et cetera. But that your body's choices are dictated by something outside the world. And that, more importantly, in line with Bandersnatch, right, it really is all digital. It is all a computer simulation. And like, this is like, if we're living in a peer-to-peer simulation, this is why particles can have multiple contradictory properties at once, because one computer can process, you know, I fired the bullet and the bullet's here, and another computer could say, well, I did the calculations and the bullet's there, and it can be two places at once, literally, in that way. And then even, like, this is why you get interference patterns whenever you deal with quantum mechanics, is it seems that the locations, the different locations that the particle has, interferes with itself, and it affects where it ultimately ends up in the world. The same thing's going on here. The computers read off of each other and figure out what different calculations they made, and they adjust accordingly. And I am not doing it justice at all. The point is that the argument that he makes is that this, the peer-to-peer simulation hypothesis can solve, it can rectify quantum mechanics and relativity. Quantum mechanics treats everything not as particles. Relativity treats everything as particles. They're incompatible in that way. The peer-to-peer simulation solves that. The peer-to-peer simulation solves why we have a sense of personal identity and free will. It solves the measurement problem. Why is it that when we observe things, they go down, they collapse down into particular locales? It's because the computer, our processing, is interpreting that information, and it makes it go down there, and the other computers realize that we've made that measurement, and so they all update it, and so they all put it in the same location. Like, it solves all of these problems. And so that's not to say that it is true, but the idea that, like, explanatory powerful is, let me put it this way. Before we could make direct observations to confirm the heliocentric versus the geocentric view, the idea that, is the sun at the center of the solar system or is the earth at the center of the solar system? There were two competing models, each of which made exactly the same observations. They both predicted where you'd see the planets in the sky every night. They made all the same predictions. There was no way to observationally distinguish between these two theories. We came to accept the heliocentric version, the heliocentric theory, before we could observationally confirm it, simply because it was the better explanation. It cohered to what scientists call the criteria of adequacy, or Ted Schick specifically. I use his book a lot in my classes. It has wider scope, it's simpler, and it's more conservative. And we came to do that even though we couldn't observationally confirm it, simply because it was the better of the two explanations. We cannot observationally confirm that we're living in a peer-to-peer computer simulation. That we can't observationally confirm that. But if it is the better explanation, and if it can explain all the quantum phenomena and rectify quantum mechanics and relativity and explain why we have a sense of free will and defend the idea that we actually do have free will and sense of personal identity and solve all these other philosophical and scientific problems when nothing else can, that's a really big like checkmark in its favor for thinking that if it's not true, it's at least not crazy. And there are multiple scientists who suggest that, like, that the idea that our universe is just two-dimensional information, essentially, that we interpret, is on solid scientific grounds. So if that's true, our world is not completely like Bandersnatch, but it's not entirely different either.
Wow.
There you go. How was that? Is that okay?
My mind is simultaneously blown and destroyed. That was absolutely amazing. I have one last question for you. If you could ask Charlie and Annabelle one question about Black Mirror, what would it be?
Yeah, I'm afraid that my question would be the one that you asked me before. Which technology would you like to see, and which technology... are you most afraid of, right? The other question I would like to ask him is, would you write a foreword for the second edition of my book?
Very, very good question.
But I guess that I think that the question I would ask would be to get at what you were asking before, like to really dig and find out, do you have a message here, or are you really just telling stories? Or are you trying to make a point? And if so, what kind of points do you think that you're trying to make? And I think that that would be I think that would be the question I would ask if I didn't ask them, like, what technology do you most fear and which one would you most like to be would you most like to be real? And I think that, you know, especially when he says that it's not a technological problem we have, it's a human one, right? That he has human foibles in mind when he's writing the episode. So the episodes have to be some kind of commentary on that. But
yeah,
hopefully that wasn't a disappointing answer. But
No, it was a very good answer. And that's it for today's episode of Black Mirror Cracked. Thank you again to Dr. David Carl Johnson. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was very informative. It has, as I said, completely blown my tiny mind. Where can our listeners find you on the wider internet?
Well, just Google my name, David Kyle Johnson, and you will find me in multiple places. I have a Facebook page that's under Dr. David Kyle Johnson. I post articles of mine when I publish stuff. It goes up there. Kyle8425 on Twitter. I don't use Twitter that much, but if you want to find me there, I occasionally post articles there. If you're interested in my work, there's two places to go. First place to go is Great Courses. I have three courses on there, one on metaphysics, one's an intro to philosophy course. So one's called Exploring Metaphysics, one's called The Big Questions of Philosophy, the other one is called Sci-Fi, Science Fiction as Philosophy. If you want to know what it's like to be in one of my courses, that's how you do it. I actually teach courses at King's based on all three of those courses. So it's like being in my classroom. If you're interested in my academic work, go to academia, Google my name and academia.edu, David Kyle Johnson, academia.edu. And I have a page there, and I've posted pretty much everything I've ever published is up there. My journal articles, my pop culture articles, conference papers, and it's on a wide range of subjects. I do philosophy of religion. I do some metaphysics, stuff on free will. I recently did something on medical misdiagnosis. So that's where they can find me there. But basically just Google me and find me on Facebook, Twitter, academia.edu.
And that's it for this episode of Black Mirror Cracked. Thank you again to Dr. David Kyle Johnson for joining us. The book Black Mirror and Philosophy, Dark Reflections is out now. So have a search for it on Amazon or have a look in our show notes. Black Mirror Cracked. We'll be right back.